Seton. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And I have Bruce here on the phone. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Lynn and all.
It's good to hear your wonderful voice, and happy to join you here on Saturday morning. You've given me a link to a question and then from the FASM outreach, and then you're suggesting we could start with today's workbook lesson, which I think is great because today's workbook lesson is really one of my favorites.
Me too.
Miracles are seen in light. So I go for that. Let's do that and then look at the question from the FASM outreach, and I think we're going to get some illumination.
Yeah. I also like to think, you know, when I read the word light in A Course in Miracles, I also have to stop and remind myself if A Course is only and always about the mind, and the spirit that we can learn to choose instead of the dream, then the light that it's talking about is always within the mind, and therefore is what we as egos would call metaphoric, but is literal in the sense that it has nothing to do with photons or electromagnetic wavelengths and frequencies, but has everything to do with the illumination of the mind, which we think is metaphor, but that's only because we're so accustomed to the dark as egos.
Right. And we see it as metaphor because we can't see it any other way when we're looking through the ego thought system. Mm-hmm. And the same thing as vision. You know, Jesus talks about light, he talks about vision. And of course, you know, the first thing you think when you see vision is, you know, what I see with my eyes.
Optometry.
But we also know there's lots of other ways that vision is given to us, and people have visions, and and if someone has got some real foresight into something, you say, oh, he has real vision, you know, but what does he mean by that? So it sounds like we have a couple of things that, you know, maybe the frequently asked question is kind of about a definition, and here we're talking about definitions. What is light? What is vision?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a good topic. So do you want to start by reading the lesson?
Sure. Before I do, I thought I'd also mention something that's very, very contemporary in terms of my personal experience. Last night, my wife and I watched Doctor Strange, which is one of the Marvel comic series.
Oh, I love that movie.
It was a great fun. And you know, very highly entertaining, just amazing special effects. Which whenever I watch, you know, any movie where you have, you know, multiple pages and pages of people doing the special effects, it reminds me that okay, that again, speaking of metaphors, is that, you know, we're in this vast movie of holographic nature of proportions so immense we can't even fathom it. But when you watch a movie that has really wonderful special effects as this one did, I thought anyway, it's like, well, I also have to stop and remind myself, okay, that is just a tiny, tiny fragment of a shadow of of an inkling of the special effects that we employ to make this world seem real. And anyway, but there were a few moments in there where they had a few little metaphysical gems in the dialogue, and you know, and actually some fairly non-dual inspirations, I think. And then, of course, with the typical Hollywood film, they, you know, lapse very promptly and you know, successively and predominantly in making it about the body and the body's welfare and so forth. But there are a few little gems in there that if you're looking for them that you might enjoy. I thought anyway, just some of the Eastern philosophy that was not too watered down in terms of the non-dual metaphysics that A Course in Miracles attempts to remind us about. So.
Well, and it's great. Doctor Strange is one of those characters that, you know, he doesn't have his power isn't from his strength of his body or his ability to fly or you know, whatever. His power is actually one of bending space and time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he's actually closer to being able to be like a miracle worker, more like, you know, what I envision Jesus was capable of doing, because he was not convinced of the reality of the illusion. And that's what I think is cool about Doctor Strange, is you see that it's all illusion, and that, you know, these beings are able to rearrange it and do things with it that seem like magic, but really all they're doing is bending the illusion. And and that's what Jesus did. That's what he said. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a man who saw the Christ in everyone, and I remembered God. Uh-huh. And from that time on, you know, I was not the body itself was just an instrument to be used in whatever way possible and necessary to teach, communicate.
Exactly. So, and even the premise of that film, without being too much of a spoiler alert, is, you know, here's a person who's steeped in Western medical tradition, is very skeptical about, you know, mystical, you know, perspectives, and through, series of circumstances, finds himself in a position to have nothing left to try. And so he, you know, literally goes to the Orient and experiences that wake up call, that, you know, is sometimes symbolized by that, you know, culture and philosophy that I think is where so much of A Course in Miracles comes from, and why oftentimes it's compared to Buddhism more than Christianity, even though the language is Christian in tone. He discovers that he needs to question his beliefs. He needs to question everything and to not assume that he knows anything. And I think that's what A Course in Miracles suggests, is that, you know, that we, if we base our understanding and our, you know, awareness on anything having to do with this world, we're barking up the wrong tree again. and you know, we need to go back to square one. And I think that's something that we need to constantly remind ourselves of as we study and learn to apply A Course in Miracles, is that, you know, nothing in this world is as it seems. And we're never upset for the reason we think that, and we could choose peace instead of what appears to be, you know, in front of us at any moment. Including anything having to do with our body or other people's bodies or circumstances, including our finances and our relationships with other bodies and the personas that seem to be the puppet masters of those bodies and, you know, all that stuff. So anyway, I thought it was an interesting film and had some high entertainment value, great special effects, and a few little metaphysical gems in the dialogue. So, you know,
it was good. And he was a brain surgeon. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that's so cool about it. He was a brain surgeon who had his whole life was based on being a miracle worker for persons who had problems with their brains.
Right, and, right. yeah. So a real world analog, I guess is the right word, or an analogy would be Jill Bolt Taylor, who had a really interesting experience several years ago. And, you know, she wrote this book called My Stroke of Insight, I think it's called. I haven't read the book, but I remember seeing the TED Talk video and being very impressed with it and watching it multiple times several years ago. But she basically, you know, had a stroke that left half of her brain, the left side of her brain, paralyzed. And because of that experience, had essentially a mystical experience of recognizing that duality was just something that we impose on our perceptual data. And that's what our egos are so proud of training themselves to do. But, you know, that without the left hemisphere of the brain, you know, doing its gig, so to speak, that's just, you know, something that we've learned and become and very, you know, proud and skilled in doing as humans. But that isn't the whole picture. In fact, it usually deprives us of that wholeness. Now, and as she's quick to point out, she doesn't prescribe shutting down your left hemisphere via a stroke or any other means as a way of having a mystical experience. But she said in her case, that provided a, you know, tremendous opportunity for her to recognize that, that you know, that we're seeing things from a very, very limited perspective because of the structure that we impose upon it. You know, all the meaning that we've given it, as those early workbook lessons point out.
Exactly. And I love that you brought that, Jill Bolte Taylor, because her whole story was so helpful to me.
Oh, yeah.
Believe it or not, when I lost my eye, you know, I had lost my right eye. I have no vision in that eye. And I, you know, I know from understanding something about how the brain works that the right eye actually connects to the left hemisphere.
Correct.
Uh-huh. So, you know, all of a sudden, I only have my right left.
Yeah, really. Hut, hut, hut. Sounds like a drill sergeant or a football watcher or something. Yeah. I was also laughing because when I was, you know, agreeing with you, I was saying, yeah, my left hemisphere agrees with what you just said about the right eye connected to.
Well, you know, I think that actually, because so much of what we believe about the world is based on what we see with the eyes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so when there's no signal from that eye going to the brain telling it what it's seeing, it's like, you know, that just suddenly went extinct. And so, you know, all that has been transferred. I don't know how it works. But I do know that, it shifted my awareness. Huh. And, you know, maybe because I knew that, or maybe because I recognized that, you know, maybe that was part of the purpose for it, was, you know, I was too much into my, analytical mind. And I really needed to, get into my visual mind, I don't know, psychic mind, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
the
I don't know.
Vision in the way the Course describes it, in other words, right?
Yeah, real vision. Yeah. Which, you know, when I first lost the eye, that was a big thing. You know, I was, you know, reading these lessons about vision and seeing and, you know, above all else, I want to see. And, you know, I was going through a lot of things trying to repair the vision. And, you know, surgical and that type of stuff. And, but, you know, my husband had a dream one night and Jesus came to him in the dream. And, I don't know if I've told this story, but I think I have in the past, but, people may not have heard it and it's interesting. Jesus comes to my husband in dreams. My husband does not believe in Jesus. He has absolutely no spiritual. He is an atheist or an agnostic or whatever. And so he gets mad because Jesus comes to him because he doesn't like Jesus. He doesn't believe in Jesus. You know, and you know, he was thinking Jesus was really a jerk. Because he kept coming to him and giving him things and telling him things. And in the morning he would say, "Your Jesus was in my dream last night and this is what he said." And, cause he knew, you know, in his mind, even though he doesn't believe in it, he knew that he was there to give him a message for me because, you know, for some reason he's my, Oracle, my husband. Yes.
Yeah.
So, anyway, my Jesus came to him in his dream and he said to him, you know, "I'm going to show you why it is that Lynn is, you know, losing her eye." And he had like an orb in his hand. And my husband has no idea what this meant. He says he showed him the orb and he looked at it and he said, "You think that it means this." And then he turned the orb over and he said, "Lynn thinks that it means this." And then he turned the orb over again and he said, "But really what it means is this." And of course, my husband didn't understand any of it other than he didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what it meant. But really there was a purpose. And, so he said, "I don't know what this means, but this is what he told me. So you make of it what you will." And I did, you know, what I made of it was, oh, there is a purpose to this. And it is, you know, whether, you know, it's my Jesus or not, there's a reason for it. And, you know, I think that it is because, you know, this whole question of vision is so important mm-hmm. in our, because the vision is the main thing that fools us.
Right.
You know, this vision, this sight, this, you know, this thought that there is a before and after and a now and then, all that kind of stuff. It all comes from this vision. So anyway, so why don't you start reading the lesson?
Sure, sure.
And we'll talk about it.
Okay. Lesson 91 in the workbook starts out the title being Miracles Are Seen in Light. And the first paragraph reads, it is important to remember that miracles and vision, and again, we're talking about the mind and only the mind, not photons and electromagnetics. I'll start that again. It is important to remember that miracles and vision necessarily go together. This needs repeating and frequent repeating. It is the central idea in your new thought system and the perception that it produces. The miracle is always there. Its presence is not caused by your vision. Its absence is not the result of your failure to see. It is only your awareness of miracles that is affected. You will see them in the light. You will not see them in the dark. Again, metaphoric. Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. And so basically what he's saying here is he says the miracle is always here. And I was just thinking back to yesterday's lesson where he's talking about, I think the last ones yesterday were my brain is suddenly frozen. let me look real quick because I have it. Yesterday's was a review of let me recognize the problem so it can be solved, and let me recognize the problem has been solved. And he says very clearly in that review lesson and in those lessons that the miracle itself is always here. I'm not seeing it because I'm misusing time, and I believe that the problem comes first and the time must lapse before it can be worked out. And but the fact is that the miracle is always there. It's behind every event. And one of the things that he says to us that we could say during the day is time cannot separate this problem from its solution. And then from the other one, the miracle behind this grievance will resolve itself for me. My answer to this problem is the miracle that it conceals. And so there's a miracle behind everything. There's a miracle behind everything we perceive here, because that's what happened. I think he says it in like chapter 2 or 3 somewhere, that the moment that we have the tiny mad idea and created all this that we see right here, right now, time and space forever and ever, you know, in our minds, that the Holy Spirit went into that scene, that story, and put a miracle behind everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the Holy Spirit's vision is through the miracle, and that means that there's a miracle behind this right now, you and I sitting here talking together. There's a miracle here, and it can be had just by asking for it. It can be had just by accepting it. And you think, well, you know, why do we need a miracle when Lynn and Bruce are just, you know, talking about the lesson or whatever? The miracle is essential because my mind needs to be open in order to really grasp what is being said here. And my mind is not open if I'm thinking with my brain. My mind is not open if I'm seeing with my eyes. My mind is not open if I'm listening through my ears. My mind is only open when I'm seeing through the light of the miracle. And so, you know, this is important. It's, you know, I love, you know, Jesus says important a lot in here. And when he says important, you know, he's really meaning it, this is something you should be part of your practice.
There are quite a number of places in the courses, well, several places, let's say, where it's emphasized, you know, like this is the central thought the course attempts to teach, for example, that you know, there is no world. And I think that's why, you know, those kinds of ideas are such, you know, seminal and vital ideas that are emphasized that in order to see, we have to give up all that we believe about the world and all of our investments in our identity in a world that makes us separate and apart from others. And that's, you know, a hugely important concept and a vital part of vision, is that as long as we think there's some shred of value in the concept of separation and the world that we made up to support that concept, we're not seeing, and we're not going to be at peace. We're going to overlook the innocence that's behind everyone and everything. And our vision, in a literal sense, using the metaphysical sense of literal, will be in darkness. You know, we'll have the facade and the clouds and the obscurities, you know, the obscurations, the stuff that we put in front, let's put it that way, you know, blocking our spiritual sight, you know, and that's no fun, in truth.
absolutely. And I was thinking about Anita Morjani, who mm-hmm. was, I'm sure you're probably aware of her, but she said that in her book, she said that it was like you were in a place that you were in complete darkness, but you had a little light, like a little flashlight, and you could turn on the flashlight and look around, and you could see the things that were in your immediate area, but uh-huh. only as long as you have the flashlight on. And this is right. this is our vision here in the world.
Yeah.
But good metaphor. What happens if all of a sudden the floodlights come on and you recognize that you were in a vast, vast warehouse that is filled with billions and billions of things, and your vision just could go on and on and on forever. And, you know, this is what I think she's, you know, her thought was that she was suddenly shown that there was so much far beyond what her vision was capable of seeing in this world. And then, you know, she came back into the world. And so she recognizes that there's more beyond. And this is what Jesus is saying. You're only able to see as far as that little flashlight can show you. And it's not a whole heck of a lot. Mm-hmm. But if you recognize that there is a miracle here, that the miracle is always here, and it is the light. It actually is the light that will come on and, you know, show you everything. Then you begin to get used to asking for the miracle whenever there seems to be a darkness. And this is what we as miracle workers are supposed to do. When there's a difficulty, when there's an upset, when we are in fear, when we're in need, whatever it is, you know, the lacking thing that the ego tells us is really happening here. If we're actually able to ask for the miracle, then we'll be shown far beyond the limited situation we appear to be in. And, you know, not that we'll be, you know, seeing everything, because right now, you know, my particular mind is not ready for that, but to see beyond it and to see the truth. And, you know, I used this a lot when I was first doing the course. These few lessons were very essential to me when I was first doing the course, because I was recognizing that I wasn't seeing everything that there was to be seen. And yet I did see a pattern of no matter whatever happened, I always survived. Mm-hmm. No matter how dark things were, I always survived. And so I recognized that no matter what bad things appeared to be happening, that I was always taken care of. But I wasn't actually turning to that every time something seemed dark. I was spending a lot of time wallowing around in darkness and being afraid. And this is a way to just turn it completely around.
Yeah, yeah. And that whole thought system of fear, which includes the belief in sin or you know, basically ego's misinterpretation of an innocent mistake or error that it just ascribes meaning to, that like, oh, there's something really bad or wrong about, you know, a dream. Well, no, dreams are neutral. And so anything in a dream is neutral, but, you know, that whole thought system is, called into question when we have vision, and but not in any kind of a demeaning or derogatory or punitive way. It's just basically looking at a dream with the eyes that have woken up and seen that there wasn't anything there, and so there's nothing to condemn or judge in something that's not there.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the old snake in the rope thing, you know, and you're walking down a dark path with your flashlight, and and you see a snake, and you freak out, and then, you know, maybe you get bravely a little closer and notice it's a rope, and you know it's not a snake. That's, you know, and you know there's that, nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah. Somehow that reminded me of something my dad used to say, who hasn't been on this planet for a few decades now. He used to talk about the elusive fan belt snake, which is when you drive quickly down the road, you see something that you think is a snake, but when you stop and get out and look at it, it's usually like an old fan belt that, you know, that felt flew off somebody's car, you know, kind of thing. But that's kind of, you know, the monsters that we make up are kind of all like our elusive fan belt snakes or the rope snake, you know, that when we look more carefully, it says, oh, it's really something else. But like you say, it's like Anita Mirjani's metaphor of, you know, this, you know, much greater light reveals that our fears are unfounded and that whole thought system is unfounded. But we don't see that as long as we're in the, what A Course in Miracles calls dark, of thinking that we have the big picture, which of course we just see the tiniest little shrap of a reflection of an echo of you know, a very abridged version of what we made up to be reality.
Yeah. Like Plato's cave, you know. We're just seeing the shadows and thinking it's all there is.
Really? Do you want to read the next paragraph? Maybe we can get to the lesson in half an hour, and then the question in half an hour or something like that. How's that sound?
Okay, we'll get that then. I'll read the next paragraph.
Okay.
So, to you then, light is crucial. While you remain in darkness, the miracle remains unseen. Thus, you are convinced it is not there. This follows from the premises from which the darkness comes. Denial of light leads to failure to perceive it. So denial of light leads to failure to perceive it. Failure to perceive light is to perceive darkness. The light is useless to you then, even though it is there. You cannot use it because its presence is unknown to you. And the seeming reality of the darkness makes the idea of light meaningless. So this is all in my thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, he's talking perception, and he's talking thought. And this is, we're so fooled by perception that we don't even think that there's something beyond it. But then, of course, you know, Dr. Strange goes to wherever he went to and sees all of a sudden, hey, there's light here that I just never even imagined because I was so caught up in my own darkness.
Yep. Exactly. Okay. Should I read the next one?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. To be told that what you do not see is there sounds like insanity. It is very difficult to become convinced that it is insanity not to see what is there and to see what is not there instead. Another example of where the Course very explicitly points out that we've got, as egos, we have just about everything backwards, you know, backwards, upside down, inside out, and totally inverted, you know, but that's the nature of the ego, is it makes everything into nothing and nothing into everything. And so we do that with time, we do that with space, we do that with every dimension that we believe is there, because we made it up to obscure reality. What we call reality in the physics sense is basically designed and carefully crafted down to the most minute and the most, you know, from the macroscopic to the microscopic detail, to be a deception. we intentionally pull the wool over our own eyes and we think we see what's not there, and we don't think we see what is there. So anyway, you do not doubt that the body's eyes can see. You do not doubt the images they show you are reality. Your faith lies in the darkness, not the light. How can this be reversed? For you it is impossible, but you are not alone in this. And then the alone, I'm sure that he's referring to, is that we all have these two thought systems. Every person we've ever met has the inclusive, essentially spiritually enlightening thought system that reminds us that we're all one being, and we get there through sameness and shared interests and forgiveness. And then we have the egoic insanity of thinking that we're all in it for ourselves, and it's the what's in it for me thought system that makes war seem justified, and any conflict and any lack of peace seem somehow sane. But we know that we have a decision-making faculty that chooses between those two thought systems, and we're not alone in that we're all in the same boat, and we're not alone in the sense of if there's really only one of us, then Jesus of A Course in Miracles or any other symbol that represents that sanity is with us all the time. It's the light that we took with us into the dream that metaphorically is shining on the seemingly specific situations that we find perplex us, but as it of course says, this need not be. This doesn't have, whatever seems to be confronting us doesn't have to be stealing of us of our peace and our innocence and our identity and the joyous recognition that we've never left home.
And you know what is real interesting here is this talk that he has about you don't doubt the images. Mm-hmm. That you see. But really, when you think about the reality of vision, even with the eyes, the reality of light, the reality of, what is it that I see when I look at you? If I look at you, Bruce, do I see you, what you are? No. I see what appears, basically to block you. Mm-hmm. The outer shell of the body, the physical being of the body, is really meant to stop and block light.
Yeah.
And reflect back only that surface. So, I can't see through the wall. I can't see, even though there's really no reason why not, it's the limitation of the eyes and the limitation of the mind. But there is no reason that I can't see what is real here, other than it's the limitation of the body. I mean, you can go with an electron microscope and see, things that are infinitely smaller than the eye could ever see. Mm-hmm. And we only know that there's something there to look for because we have an imagination that says there must be something beyond that. But mm-hmm. even if you could see through an electron microscope, the tiniest thing possible that to be seen, you still are not seeing what's really there at all. You're only seeing what's stopping the light. What's right. stopping, you're only seeing the block. Mm-hmm. You're not seeing the truth. Uh-huh. And so, how can this be reversed? And, that doesn't mean, we're going to have an x-ray vision and be able to look through people and whatever. But to see the truth of what we are, not to look at what appears that's blocking the light, and recognize that is just a thin veil over the truth of reality.
Yeah.
It's not impossible to reverse it. It's not impossible to be able to see. Stop looking at the darkness. Stop looking at the shadow. Stop looking at the block. And you will see the light.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting you mentioned that, the electron microscopes and kind of getting into the realm of the physics use of the word light and photons and electromagnetics and seeing through things. I was reminded of when I got into I guess you could call it paranormal investigation back in the 70s. Listened to a talk by Patrick Flanagan, who was talking about cosmic energy particles going through the Great Pyramid and actually being focused as that device is sort of like a lens that focuses frequencies beyond our normal range of vision, way above ultraviolet and X-rays even. And those cosmic energy particles stream through the Earth You know, and the highest frequency ones actually just go right through the earth and out the other side without even hardly being slowed down. Because at that frequency, there's really nothing to stop them. What we think of as matter becomes sort of transparent, in terms of the, at least that's my understanding anyway. In other words, there's so high energy and so little interaction with, matter that things just kind of zip right through. But there's that gradation of where things get slower and slower and then they're stopped by the matter. Anyway, the upshot of this is that, during that same era, I discovered that a neighbor who lived literally a block away from us, growing up as a kid in Livermore, California, was working with University of California, Berkeley, to do a research project in Cairo, Egypt, at the not the Great Pyramid, but the next one, the second pyramid, which is usually ascribed to Khafren, just kind of like the White House, if it was called the Trump House or the Obama House or the Bush House, we would say, huh? But that's, you know, how the pyramids, you know, basically had the name of the pharaoh that was popular at the most recent pharaoh that put his graffiti on it, essentially. But anyway, the second pyramid, the middle of the three large pyramids at the Giza complex, he had, my neighbor Nick, along with several other people from Livermore and Berkeley, had hauled over this, you know, elaborate technical apparatus that essentially measured what angle, from a 360 degree perspective, the photon energy of very high frequency cosmic particles was actually coming through, many, many feet thick of solid limestone, granite, whatever the, you know, material was for each particular strata of this huge structure. Hundreds of feet tall, they were looking for secret passageways, and they figured out a method which actually makes sense, is if the cosmic energy particles, at a certain range of frequencies get through that thickness of rock, in greater numbers, then it's probably a clue that there's, a hidden chamber there, because the essentially Geiger counter, if you will, kind of energy starts ticking off counters, the more there is, the less rock there is in the way. So they basically set up an elaborate 3D experiment where they move this apparatus around at several places in the chamber that was right under the apex of the second pyramid, and then made thousands and thousands, millions of data recordings by aiming this apparatus, which I could describe it. I'll just
sort of like ultrasound.
They could tilt these two parallel plates that had high voltage applied them to make a zap between two grids, and they could measure the angle of where that the photons were, you know, starting through one grid and passing through the other grid. They could measure the angle and then the frequency of those occurrences. And then they had, you know, in that day, in the era of, you know, the mid to late 70s when they were doing this, you know, pretty, what by today's standards, primitive computing technology, but it was still pretty sophisticated, and they were able to figure out and moving this apparatus around to different places in this, you know, medium-sized chamber underneath the second pyramid, where they made a three-dimensional map of the Great the second pyramid, and with the attempt to try to find if there was a hidden passages there. And they finished this experiment, and they didn't really find anything, but they showed the exact outline of where the four triangular faces would be. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. And so it was unsuccessful in the sense that they didn't find any hidden passageways. But what they did do one time is they turned this apparatus completely on its side, and then they pointed it, so to speak, at where the first pyramid would be, a.k.a. the Great Pyramid, usually attributed to Cheops. And what did they find? But they didn't – what you'd expect to see is just sort of like a black foreground, because hardly any cosmic particles would be coming all the way through, you know, the Earth, to get to where they were, at that frequency. But you'd expect you would have a little gray triangle above the Great Pyramid, where the, you know, where the Great Pyramid was. And then it would be white, you know, cause, or lighter, the lightest shade, where they would be coming through only the second pyramid. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, oh, okay. But what he showed me it wasn't a photograph, but it was a computer-generated image in the very early days of computer graphics, and I wish I had a copy of it, because I would love to have that to share on the web. But it was a really fascinating image to me, because it confirmed what Patrick Flanagan and other people who are studying pyramid energy were saying, is that this structure was focusing those particles at those frequencies, because there was like a corona around the Great Pyramid. So it was actually brighter. Mm-hmm. It was actually brighter around the apex and around the edges of the Great Pyramid than you would expect. So it means somehow it was either those particles were coming in greater numbers because of the pyramid, or it was just quote unquote a fluke. Well, I don't think it was a fluke. I think it was because there was some electromagnetic thing going on there. So anyway. Yeah. But anyway, that's all about the level of form. But even on the level of form, I think there's really interesting stuff about that. And so hopefully that aside was of interest to everybody.
It is of interest. And it also brought up two things for me. Well, one thing in particular, you know, you'd think, well, how could they have, you know, these primitive people, how did they come up with this thought or figure this out? You know, Jesus tells us in the Course also, and I believe absolutely that this is true, the mind has been the same since the inception of the dream. Mm-hmm. That the mind, our mind is the same mind. And, you know, we think, oh, we're so technologically adept now, and, you know, we're so far above the caveman or the, you know, Neanderthal or whatever. Or actually, my personal belief is that it's been the same since we were amoeba, since we were one-celled animals, that the mind of the Son of God, the mind of the Christ, is the same, and the mind that made this is the same, and we were never more primitive thinkers than we are now. You know, we're equally mm-hmm. primitive as the amoeba.
Right. we've just, you know, put on emperor's clothes to say, oh, I'm smarter because I have this technology that's more whiz-bang. Well, you know, if again, hearkening back to that same Egypt trip where I got to see the pyramid the nine pyramids, but there's three prominent ones at the Giza complex where Nick did his work. Farther up the Nile, which is south, there's a temple at Abydos, Egypt, that depicts things that, you know, about 20 feet in the air on this lintel or header that goes across, things that look remarkably like flying saucers, helicopters, jet aircraft, and it's like, well, okay, so is it just history repeating itself? And you know, the Plato's story of Atlantis, you know, would suggest that, well, maybe we are, you know. so we're so provincial in the time dimension, in the space dimension, and the species dimension too. As you were saying about, like, talking about amoebas, I was thinking, well, what, and I try to remember that when, you know, one of our cats walks into the room, you know, it's like, they're just as aware as we are. They just have, a vocabulary that, from our perspective, that isn't as fancy, but, I mean, they're no less a part of the Son of God as any other part, including the pen that's on my desk, or the tree that I, you know, the spruce tree that I see out the window, or a drop of water in the ocean that's a little farther out that same window. You know, it's the same self, the same stuff, but we want to divide it up, like Jill Bolte-Taylor's revelation. It's like, those are just artificial divisions. They're just made up differences that. You know, really don't have any bearing in the eternal truth that was what we're all getting at. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Jesus says that same thing throughout the Course. If you know, to me, you know, the more I look at it, the more I recognize, wow, he's been saying this the whole time. And, I couldn't believe, I guess, that it could be true. But, you know, I see now how clear it is. You think about also, if you understand anything about the Earth as far as plate tectonics goes, you know, people will say, well, you know, we don't have any evidence, or there's nothing, you know, there's no physical evidence that any of these things occurred. what, you know, I recognize is that as because of the shifting of the plates of the earth and things going under and things going over, there is just, you know, millions of years of history that have, you know, gone completely and will never be dug up archaeologically because it's shifted from our vision, our ability to even connect to it. Things are under the ocean, you know, all the time they're finding stuff down at the bottom of the ocean that are like, where did this come from and how can this be? And you know, I don't know if all these things are true, but, you know, evidence of cities and evidence of cultures and societies that we have no idea what they had or what they did. And of course, you're talking back in the 70s, and you probably may or may not have gotten involved in the lost continent of Mu, but that that was a big deal too. You know, you're talking about. I was thinking about Uri Geller, and I was into all that stuff.
I still have fun with that. Yeah.
I mean, I started with Edgar Cayce when I was like 12.
Uh-huh, you know, yeah.
all those guys are saying all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And of course, you know, rational minds are saying, well, that's, you know, not true. But if you can imagine it, it happened. If you can imagine it, it's a part of the dream. There's nothing in our imagination that hasn't been manifested.
Inquiring minds want to know.
Exactly. So, you know, people are, well, don't think about that because it might happen. Well, no, it already did. If it's in your mind, it already did. You know, this idea of mind is quite flexible as well. Let's see. So let's get back to the lesson.
yes. Why not?
Interesting.
Why not?
I love this conversation.
All right. Me too. And I'll put some links to some of these things. I actually found the blog post from a decade ago that I put about Nick Chekakis and his cosmic energy.
Well, cool.
Yeah. So I'll post a link to that too.
I'll read that. No, I'm interested in seeing that.
Yeah.
So let's see.
Okay.
So,
I think we're only about the third paragraph or third or fourth paragraph.
Yeah, I think, did you read the third paragraph?
I think I might have read the second paragraph.
You read the second one because I started. So.
Yeah.
Okay. To be told what you do not see is there sounds like insanity. It is very difficult to become convinced that it is insanity not to see what is there and to see what is not there instead. You do not doubt that the body's eyes can see. You do not doubt the images they show you are reality. Your faith lies in the darkness, not the light. How can this be reversed? For you, it is impossible, but you are not alone in this. Wow.
We did read that one, but it bears repeating, doesn't it? Yeah.
But it is worth repeating because I just really saw that, it has to be reversed.
Yeah.
This vision has to be reversed.
Yep.
And thank God that we are not alone in this and that we do have the help. And, you know, that's one thing I also was thinking because I've been really involved in this oneness movement. And the oneness movement, we're looking at the Holy Spirit, our connection to the divine. You know, one of the main things that they emphasize is don't try to go anywhere without that. You know, Jesus tells us that throughout the course, but, you know, I've my whole time been like, well, I can do it until I get in trouble and then I'll ask for help. But, you know, they're teaching us don't even think about doing anything without asking that help because that help is here, and it's necessary. You're not going to be able to do it without it. You're not going to be able to do it without asking the Holy Spirit for help.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how much you think you can, it's impossible because the ego is your only thought system, and the Holy Spirit has to replace that thought system. As long as you keep thinking with the ego thought system, it's like pulling yourself up by your bootstraps.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible. You cannot pull yourself up by your bootstraps. All you can do is make yourself fall down. And, right. You know, so the Holy Spirit's here for that. So, how about I read the next paragraph?
Sure, sure.
Okay. Your efforts, however, little they may be, have strong support. Did you but realize how great this strength, your doubts would vanish. Today, we will devote ourselves to the attempt to let you feel this strength. When you have felt the strength in you, which makes all miracles appear miracles within your easy reach, you will not doubt. The miracles your sense of weakness hides will leap into awareness as you feel the strength in you. So this is one of those lessons where he's saying, if you do this, you will have this experience. If you do this, you will have this experience. And so, you know, how many times I've done these lessons and haven't, you know, had the experience, you know, I'm just, you know, recognizing this year has been a lot. And so I recognize that I haven't really been doing the lesson that I had.
I think the converse is true also, is that not only does ego, you know, fight doing the lessons because it knows it leads to its undoing, but also it doesn't recognize the times when we are successful. And it says, oh, no, that really didn't work. I mean, because it has no cognizance of peace. So it's like in its transcript, its court recording, you know, documentation says nothing happened when you chose the teacher of peace because it's off its record. Because the two records seen through the two completely exclusive, you know, mutually exclusive thought systems are totally contradictory. And that's because in truth, there is no falsehood. And in a falsehood, there's no truth. And so it's almost like, when we listen to the ego, there's nothing on the Holy Spirit's, director's cut, of the soundtrack of the movie we're watching. And then conversely, when we listen to the Holy Spirit, there's nothing on the ego's recording. Because it doesn't know how to respond to that because there's nothing happening in terms of the ego. And that's why it starts panicking. And that's when it goes from suspicion to viciousness because it starts freaking out. It's like, wait, where did I go? I'm being chosen against her, but I don't know what's being chosen because I'm not aware of that oneness. I had to laugh when you said oneness movement. I was thinking how amusing our dualistic languages is, you know, like I was thinking, well, gee, I want to get my address book out. So if you know where oneness ends up moving, I want to keep track of it and stay in touch.
That is hilarious. Yeah. Well, I think oneness is moving home.
Yeah, really. But where is it moving and how did it get the appropriate permissions to do the moving? Yeah. Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
And how did it get somewhere it has to move to or from?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What happened here? How did that happen? Yeah. Oh, how funny.
Should I read the next one?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Three times today, set aside about 10 minutes for a quiet time in which you try to leave your weakness behind. This is accomplished very simply as you instruct yourself that you are not a body. Faith goes to what you want, and you instruct your mind accordingly. Your will remains your teacher, and your will has all the strength to do what it desires. You can escape the body if you choose. You can experience the strength in you. And I think we demonstrate to ourselves that principle. I think one of my earliest recollections of that is playing hide and seek with, you know, the neighborhood kids. And, you know, if I would, you know, get a little scraped or bruised, you know, scrambling to find a hiding place in the last 2 seconds of, you know, counting to zero, the guy who was it. I was, you know, if I found a really cool hiding place, I was so enthused, I didn't even notice it. And then when you get home and, you know, when your folks said, oh, I see you got, you know, banged up, it's like, oh yeah, I guess that does hurt, you know, but it's out of your awareness while you're in the exhilaration of playing that game kind of thing. But I think the same thing is true is, you know, when we're focused on, recognizing the essence of each other. And I find this oftentimes when I'm doing things like this with you, Lynn, and other programs I do where I'm recording and or sharing things about the course. It's like when my mind is on that wavelength, I'm not feeling, sciatic stuff in my legs from sitting too long or whatever. And maybe even unconsciously I move around so I don't experience that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that mindset actually, does, a couple of things. Is I think it actually helps us do what we can do within the dream to minimize our experience of the pain or discomfort that we think is physical, but it also puts our mind in a totally different space where even if those sensations are happening, the interpretation, more importantly, is no longer, valid because we don't, in those moments, we're not thinking of ourselves as being a body. We're recognizing that we really are spirit and that we really are all each other as that one spirit.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's perfect. It is, what you focus on is what you're going to experience, whatever you're focusing on.
Exactly.
So, if you, you went to the movies, I don't know if you went out to a movie or if you saw it at home, but, you're watching a movie and if it's really a good movie, you get caught up into it. And
right.
Then, you don't notice, sounds around you or people rustling around or, whatever. But mm-hmm. then, people start doing things like, messing with their cell phones or, you start getting this disturbance and it takes you away from the focus on the movie. And so that's the way it is with, actually looking from a different direction at the world and at your brothers, at yourself, you can learn to see a different way.
Right.
And right now we're focused on the screen and we're focused on the movie and we're so caught up in the movie that we're not noticing anything. But as we begin to recognize that what we're seeing is just a screen, it is something that is preventing us from seeing the reality of what's really there, then we maybe start looking or listening for things to be a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, I think for me, it's been this relationship with people that I've found myself and find myself in a lot of times looking at the differences between us and using that to stop communication, to break communication, or to make me believe that this person is either worthy or not worthy of my full attention, or no one's worthy of my full attention, but worthy of a lot of my attention. I'm the one who's making the decisions, and I'm making the decisions based on differences that I perceive. And these differences that I perceive, if I stop looking specifically for differences and instead start looking specifically for samenesses, then what I see is a tremendous shift in my perception, my opinion, my thought completely. Just for an example, and I'm just bringing it up because it's a political situation in this country right now. I have been looking at persons in office and seeing, oh, they're evil, they're bad, they're trying to do bad things, they're trying to be hurtful, thinking a lot of very negative things. And it occurred to me after much contemplation and begging for help, because I was so miserable with that point of view. That point of view was killing me.
Sure,
and
sure.
I was so miserable with that point of view that, I just had to shift it. And mm-hmm. so, what I was given was, look at them and put yourself in their shoes,
mm-hmm.
basically. Be if you were that person. And what happened when I was being as if I were that person, I was not being arrogant and evil and intently trying to cause harm. I was terrified.
Right, right.
I was just in terror. I was so afraid of everything that I saw that I knew I had to make a defense against it. And I had to hide, and I had to, you know, if there was anybody I loved, I needed to protect them from it. You know, I began to see the mindset of persons who were thinking in that way because I saw it was my own mindset. I was terrified. I was thinking, if I don't stop these people, if I can't make this right, you know, I'm worried about the earth. I'm worried about, you know, like, you know, somehow or the other, we have say over what happens in the illusion. You know, I recognize that I was worried about all these illusions as they are. In fact, I started looking at things that they were saying and recognizing that I think the same thing, only in a different way.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I'm accusing a different person or a different thing of being harmful. I'm imagining, you know, people are imagining, oh, I lost my job as a coal miner and therefore my family is going to starve versus, you know, get that damn coal out of here because, you're killing the earth. You know, both of those points of view were equally valid. And yet equally incorrect because they both were focusing on something that wasn't the truth.
Right.
And I was buying into it.
Yeah. And that's sort of a funny you should mention department for me because last night, after I watched the movie with my wife that we were talking about, we put on Bill Maher and one of his guests was a politician who I think unconsciously was sort of letting some of the disparaging remarks I'd heard by various media pundits, you know, influence my perception, and then I heard him speak directly, you know, and I didn't agree with much of what he said, but I recognized the humanity and the real being behind this person who was speaking, and it was like, you know, I think it helps sometimes to remember that we're all in the same predicament. We're all in the same crazy, crazy dream that pits us against each other because we set it up that way. And we, you know, I try to watch media that at least makes fun of the differences, even while it, you know, highlights them and shows the news du jour that is usually about conflict in one kind or another. But I think I try to emphasize things that work toward at least, an inclusive perspective and start with that as a, you know, foundational premise. And at the same time that, you know, you see how quickly, you know, our minds get into a we-they tug-of-war kind of craziness and just watch yourself and everyone else participating in that process and just say, wow, this need not be. I don't have to think of what I'm hearing and seeing with my photon mirror of my own projected mind, that this as an assault to what I am. Another comment that you made about the theater and the dream metaphors. A few years ago, and I'll wrap this up real quickly because I know we're running out of time in terms of our hour and a half here that we usually have. When I was putting together a working title for the second book that I've done, I was thinking about, you know, forgiving the dream of separation. And that was sort of part of the working title of the working subtitle, actually, of the book that I put together. And then I realized, you know, as I got closer to publishing it, it's like, well, that really is not the point. I mean, forgiving the dream is like, you know, it's level of confusion is putting the cart before the horse because it doesn't really matter what's going on the screen. We have to forgive the dreamer of separation. And so that fortunately made its way onto the title of my book, the subtitle actually, before it went to print, because I think that changes everything. It's really like, In one of Ken Wapnick's, he talks about there's two notes that Beethoven added to the beginning of one of his most powerful pieces of music, that those first two notes set the tone for the entire rest of the composition. And I think that premise makes a huge difference, is that, you know, when we forgive the dreamer of separation, we're forgiving the decision-making faculty, and realize that has nothing to do with the characters that appear on a pundit talk show or that that walk through the house with us, whether they eat human food or cat food or or whatever, you know. Anyway, hopefully that was helpful, because I find it helpful to remember that it's not the dream I need to forgive, it's the dreamer, and that
exactly
it always comes back to numero uno here. So.
And then that's always, always, always the case.
Yeah.
So you can escape the body if you choose, and you can experience the strength in you. He's really talking about overcoming this body, this sense of self separation. And for us, you and me, and everyone who's listening to us right now, and I know this for a fact, I have no doubt in my mind whatsoever, anybody listening on the radio or in the room or whatever, or in a recording later on, you're here because you have chosen to change your mind and to be a miracle worker. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to be a miracle worker, this is just my thought here about this, and it's only for myself. If I'm going to be a miracle worker, then I cannot be a shit stirrer upper. I can't be.
We've definitely put miracles on hold when we stir the shit. That's for sure. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. In our mind, and that's the only place it can exist, right? It's in our mind. Is the mental cesspool we call ego.
Exactly. Exactly. So give that up. You know, as much fun as it may seem, and as cool as it feels to be pointing out to your brother how stupid he is, or looking at your brother and seeing, you know, what big mistakes they're making, and wishing someone would stop them from making those big mistakes because it's going to ruin everything, you know, that's not our job. My job is not to do that. My job is to look at that, recognize that it's not really happening, and forgive the entire situation, that, you know that it's not true, and that my brother is myself. Whatever I perceive in him is what I'm projecting out. You know, so if he's doing stupid stuff, it's because I'm expecting stupid stuff. I'm looking for stupid stuff, and I'm hoping for stupid stuff so that I can be right and he can be wrong. This is buying right into the ego's ploy.
Yeah, the body's eyes are designed to see differences and to make wrong, but we don't have to go there. I was laughing because something you said triggered a memory of a line of dialogue in the Life of Brian movie, where the multitude is way off in the distance listening to Jesus give a Sermon on the Mount kind of thing, and they're so far away they can just barely hear what he's saying, and you know, something like, "Blessed are the Greeks," kind of thing. But at one point, one of the spectators is picking his nose, and maybe it's Brian, actually, I think, and Brian's mother says, "Give it a rest." Here, once again, profound spiritual wisdom given in a humorous dialogue in a Monty Python film, right? Give it a rest. I think we need to just give our constant picking and finding fault with each other and ourselves, give it a rest, right? So since we only have about 18 minutes, something like that, to read the FAQ, should we skip from the remainder of Lesson 91 to the FAQ and go through that? What do you think?
Oh, sure. You know what? Let's finish this lesson
because it's got quite
a few paragraphs left.
Okay,
and,
sure.
We might not even be able to finish it, but it's got some really important stuff.
It does. Okay, we'll save that for next week. Okay.
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 So you want to go ahead?
Sure.
We're at paragraph 6.
Begin the longer practice, that one, right? Probably?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Begin the longer practice periods with the statement of true cause and effect relationships. Miracles are seen in light. The body's eyes do not perceive the light. But I am not a body. What am I? Good rhetorical question. And the ego has no clue. Our egos have no clue because, again, there's nothing on the ego's court reporter transcript. There's nothing on the ego's director's cut when we switch to the Holy Spirit because, for all intents and purposes, the ego thinks, you know, the tape went blank. You know, there must have been a dropout on the tape. But no, it was just we switched to the thought system of light. And in that mode, you know, the ego doesn't have any cognizance of what's going on. Just as God has no cognizance of anything having to do with space or time or bodies or seemingly separate personalities. And so the twain shall never meet, as they say. Huh.
Exactly. Absolutely. And you know, that's why, you know, Jesus tells us, you know, what is the one question that that the world does not want to hear? And it's, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I am. I don't know anything about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And what you are will tell you of itself.
Yeah.
Really seriously, what am I is the question.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Cause I recall that quote now too. That's one of the more profound ones that ties into the kinds of questioning that, you know, Eastern mystics like Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta have been asking for millennia. It's like, you know, the what is the question we never ask ourselves because we're so enamored with the who, the little finite seeming separate self that we think we are.
Yeah, exactly. So if I'm not a body, what am I? Yeah. And the question with which this statement ends is needed for our exercises today. What you think you are is a belief to be undone. But what you really are must be revealed to you. The belief that you are a body calls for correction, being a mistake. The truth of what you are calls on the strength in you to bring your awareness to what the mistake conceals. If you are not a body, what are you? You need to be aware of what the Holy Spirit uses to replace the image of a body in your mind, okay? Need to be aware of what the Holy Spirit uses to replace the image of a body in your mind. You need to feel something to put your faith in as you lift it from the body. You need a real experience of something else, something more solid and more sure, more worthy of your faith and really there. And so what Jesus is talking about is this is the lesson that is going to bring about an experience.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And if you do this lesson, you will have this experience.
Exactly. And I think this is hugely important from the standpoint of, you know, a lot of the Eastern mysticism, since we've been talking about that a bit this morning, it centers on negating what's not real. I think it's just as important to have a proactive part of the curriculum, which is what the forgiveness part of A Course in Miracles does, is it asks us to see beyond the illusion and see the reality beyond it. And I think that's where the vision comes in, because the vision that's being talked about here is the vision to see the spirit, not with our physical eyes, but with our spiritual eye, so to speak, that sees the intrinsic kindness and beauty and purity and perfection and glorious, joyous essence that really is like an ecstasy that couldn't possibly be changed or diminished, because it's an eternal being that we all are. And I think that's the quality that we get glimpses of when we just drop our condemnation, even just for a moment. And, you know, like I had this experience last night of watching this politician on a talk show, you know, it's like, oh yeah, it wasn't like I was actively condemning this person in my mind, but there was just sort of like this erosion going on by not questioning some of the things I'd heard and read about this particular person. And I realized, well, I need to generalize that to everyone, you know, regardless of, you know, their political affiliation, their gender, their cultural background, that, you know, all that really in truth meaningless trivial stuff. And that's when we have those little epiphanies that give us the light that replaces the darkness. Because just saying, just, you know, damning and condemning the darkness isn't going to cut it, because that's ego's trying, it's ego's sort of, you know, masochistic attempt to try to convince you that, well, I'm with you here. you know, I'm doing this course with you. I'll destroy myself. You know, not, but you know, pretending to go along with the program. But that's only like so much of the course suggests, that just leads to depression and discouragement. Because if you do the not know correctly, and really get the heck out of the way, after revealing and releasing ego's insane curriculum, the replacement is automatic. The replacement in that forgiveness process automatically shows what's beyond the illusion, and the light is there that shines in everyone. And we feel that kinship and that love for, you know, whoever and whatever, is in front of us. And we really actually kind of transcend the who and go to the what that we all share. Right?
Yeah. And that really, that is what brings about this awakening. That mm-hmm. is really what brings about what we're looking for as far as awakening from the dream.
Yeah.
Because the dream is a dream of separation.
Mm-hmm.
And so if all we're doing is believing the things that keep us apart and believing the truth of the articles of separation, then we can't, we'll never, ever, ever, ever reassimilate or rejoin or become aware of the fact that we are joined and we're not separate. And so all these things that appear to be keeping us apart, and you know, and it seems like maybe things seem a lot worse right now, but the world has always been this way. There's never been a time when there haven't been conflict. There hasn't been conflict. It's always been this way because that's the nature of the world. Mm-hmm. So what happens when you move from being in a conflict, which is what happens when you accept the miracle and accept this experience of oneness that comes about when you drop all your ideas or beliefs in what's keeping us apart, what happens is that we are actually able to join in a very powerful way, a very real way, and a very truly helpful way.
Yes,
healing way. You know, instead of helping you out by telling you how dumb you are, you know, I'm helping you out by joining with you and seeing that we're the same.
Right. And I think A Course in Miracles does that in a very beautiful way, because it almost in every section of the text, for example, and elsewhere as well, it usually starts out in some fashion of pointing out how not evil or sinful or wicked, but how silly the ego is and its whole thought system. And then, you know, lampooning it in the kindest possible way and saying, and asking us, you know, as a decision making mind, is this really what you want? I mean, and showing it with, you know, with not any minced words. So like, here's painting sometimes very graphic pictures of the devastation that the ego has wrought in our minds, and saying, do you really want this? And then it gently reminds us and eases us into this, the light that is what we really do want, that is seemingly abstract, it is abstract, but it's seemingly unreal, because we're so accustomed to the alleged reality of our dream that you know, it takes a while after we've, you know, or begin to wake up to you know, wipe the sleep from our eyes, so to speak, and realize that, you know, there really is a beauty and a transcendence and a gentle strength that is behind the facade that we all have and that we can all bring out in each other by, you know, practicing the hints and the suggestions that our inner kindness teacher is whispering to us 24/7, and saying, hey, look at where you just condemned this person. It's like, you know, would you like to forgive yourself for that seeming infraction and, you know, pick yourself up and start all over again, you know, and give the ego's thought system a rest, you know, so to speak.
Yeah. And that forgiveness is the key to all of it. Forgiveness is the key to all of it. And, you know, when you can do that, in, you know, basically forgiveness is saying, I, this is not, what I see is not real.
Uh-huh.
What I'm seeing is an appearance of something that is not real. And And no one has ever done anything wrong. Mm-hmm. Nothing has ever occurred. My brother is innocent. And whoa, boy, does the ego hate that. You know, don't start saying these guys are innocent. No. They got to be tried. They got to go to prison. You know, lock them up. You know?
Yeah. And it doesn't mean on the level of forum that you know, maybe the kindest thing to do for certain individuals that are out, you know, hell bent on making this world a hellish place might be to spend a little jail time, you know. But it's not about the behavior. It's never about the behavior. It's always about, do I incriminate and diminish the spirit of this person that I'm thinking about or looking at or listening to, whatever. Am I condemning this person to their body and their personality? And if we're doing that in any fashion, we're condemning ourselves. And I think that's the take-home lesson of so much of the course.
Exactly. Because at the end of the play, all of the actors come out on the stage and hold hands and take a bath.
Yes, what a great metaphor that is, isn't it? Yes. Oh, thank you for that. I you know, that's a good one to remember, because that really tells it all, doesn't it? You know, when they all, you know, together in unison take that bow and their hands go back and their heads go down and you know, I mean, I'm sure anybody who's been to the theater has seen that over and over again. But that is such a wonderful tradition and a metaphor. It's like we're all in this together, putting on this elaborate show, but it's just a show, and the unity has never been broken.
Yes. And we're also recognizing that if any one of those actors would have gone out of character and started doing something that wasn't in the script, it would have ruined the whole show for everyone. Mm-hmm. You can't blame them for being the bad guy or the good guy or whatever. We're here for a show, you know?
Right. Oh, it's a huge emperor wardrobe that we're looking at, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, just thinking that Doctor Strange movie, if the bad guy would have all of a sudden said, I don't even understand why I'm being a bad guy. This makes no sense to me. I think I'm going to just stop this. And then all of a sudden all your special effects are for no reason.
Right. But I think that's what we start to do. We start to question, well, do I really need all the special effects, you know?
Yeah.
Do I really need the specialness that I'm putting into my life to make it such a big deal, and all the yada yadas that I wax on about so rhapsodically?
Yes, exactly. So we have about 5 minutes. Now, I'm just going to move down a little bit.
Sure.
Because paragraph 9 I'm going to read, because it has some really important points, I think. In the second phase of the exercise period, try to experience these truths about yourself. And the truths are, I'm not weak but strong, I'm not helpless but all-powerful, which sound like affirmations or mantras, mm-hmm. but actually they're just statements of fact.
Right.
They're statements of fact. I'm not an illusion but a reality. I cannot see in darkness but in light. Those are just statements of fact, any kind of affirmation. So try to experience these truths about yourself. Concentrate particularly on the experience of strength. Remember that all sense of weakness is associated with the belief that you are a body, a belief that is mistaken and deserves no faith. Try to remove your faith from it, if only for a moment. You will be accustomed to keeping faith with the more worthy in you as we go along. So he's given us a specific exercise here of just try to remove your faith from the belief that you are a body. Try to believe that you're something else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he doesn't say what to believe that you are. Just recognize that you're not that.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like Richard Bach's one of the little maxims in his Messiah's Handbook is, you know, if you'll practice being fictional for a while, sometimes you'll realize that fictional characters are more real than those with bodies and heartbeats, you know. And I always thought that was kind of a good reminder that it's again all the life that we've given it. We've breathed life into these fictional characters that we call human beings.
Exactly. And also, you just reminded me, it's recognizing the fictional of me.
Mm-hmm.
When I started recognizing, oh gosh, yeah, even the way I'm talking right now, the sound of my voice, the way I make inflections of words, the way that I look, dress, everything, it's all made up.
Right.
I decided to do this, right?
Exactly.
You know, I decided to, you know, as much as my mind tells me, oh, I wish I could lose 20 pounds, you know, I'm the one who decides to eat cookies. You know, knowing full well that that's, you know, going to make me not lose 20 pounds. But, you know, I hide that from myself because I really want to enjoy the cookie without the guilt. But hiding that from myself, keeping it means that the guilt is still there. I'm just not seeing it. And I'm punishing myself by getting fat.
Or whatever beliefs are associated with those thoughts and behaviors, huh? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So once I started recognizing that this entire persona of Lynn is made up,
this
makes people very uncomfortable. It made me very uncomfortable to think about it because I didn't want to face the idea that I was not real, that I was that this Lynn was not a real person, but a made-up character that I particularly decided. I'm the one who decided, oh, I want to be a scientist. You know, I want to go to school and, you know, I enjoy, you know, physics. And, you know, I'm the one who decided those things and made myself a persona that now I, you know, I show myself off as being not an expert because that would be ridiculous, but at least having working knowledge of things. I'm the one who made myself be that way. I could have easily just made myself to be a cook or a painter or a dog walker or anything and made that into my persona, but I made the persona that I think I am. I'm a fictional character in my own fictional story. And, oh gosh, we're up here at the end of the hour and a half, but.
How about if we just finish that last, second to the last paragraph? Cause I think there's a lot in it. If we can just go over a minute or
two. Okay, why don't you read that then?
Okay, all right. Relax for the rest of the practice period, confident that your efforts, however meager, are fully supported by the strength of God and all his thoughts. It is from them that your strength will come. That's the light. It is through their strong support that you will feel the strength in you. They are united with you in this practice period in which you share a purpose like their own. Theirs is the light in which you will see miracles because their strength is yours. Their strength becomes your eyes that you may see. And that's the light that we've been talking about. And the concluding phrase here is, miracles are seen in light. Let me not close my eyes because of this. So anyway,
wow.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn. It's always a joy to share about 90 minutes with you on Saturday mornings and with whoever might be listening. So
it is, and yeah. And it's great for me because I see things that I have not wanted to see before. So
me too, absolutely, yeah. And so now we can hold our hands with everyone that has ever been together and bow on the stage and say thank you for supporting all of our journey back home to where we never left. So
exactly.
Right, we'll see you next week.
All right, thank you, Bruce. I love it, brother. And
likewise.
I'll talk to you next week. And we're going to turn the mic over to Devin and Barb.
Thanks, Lynn.